Hi guys, Barry here. Just before you listen to this week's episode of Worst Foot Forward, with our excellent guest Leah Broad, where we talk about the world's worst composer. Genuinely, as we mentioned during the show, we spent a long time trying to line up this episode over a year. Thank you to our Patreon donor Kayla Bazana for being so patient with us as we sought out the ideal guest, and we did have two or three lovely musicologists and musical experts have to turn us down. A couple of them just because they didn't really want to slag off any of their contemporaries, which I don't think we do during this. Pretty much everyone we mentioned in this is dead. But Leah stepped up to the plate and was brilliant, and I think you'll enjoy this one. But yes, just before you get to listening, we have the usual bits of admin. As Ben said last week, we'll try and be fairly slick with these. You know the deal by now. We're a podcast without adverts, and it's just Ben and I making it, and we don't have any sponsorship, so if you want to help us keep making it, you can head to patreon.com/worstfootforward, chuck us a few quid, get some extra bonus content as a result, and even get to suggest topics and be a judge on the show and all sorts of things. So, if your New Year's resolution is to look after a moderately sized podcast in a financial manner, then boy, have we got the perfect fit for you. Also, you can give us support in other ways. You can write us a lovely review. We haven't asked for one of those for a while. Write a nice review for us on iTunes or wherever you listen to us. 5 stars, of course, is the only acceptable number of stars. And give us a shout out on your social media platform of choice, be it Twitter, where we're on @WorstFoot, Facebook, where you can find us if you just search for Worst Foot Forward, or share our website with people, worstfootforwardpodcast.com. And of course, you can get in touch with both Ben and I individually. Ben is on @BenVandeveld, and I'm on @BazMcStay as well. And you can also get in touch with us by email if you email worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com. A few of you do that fairly regularly. If any of you have any sort of big ideas you want to share with us, get in touch with us maybe via email. And, for ideas for live streams or special one-off episodes and things like that, we're always looking for new ideas. And indeed, suggestions of guests, people you think, God, they should really get in touch with this person. They'd be brilliant on the podcast. And you can also chat to each other if you want to do that. You can join our Discord channel. The link is in the podcast description below. That's it. Short and sweet, in and out. Barely a symphony, barely a single movement. Now sit back and relax and enjoy this week's episode all about the world's worst composer. Hello and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, where we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Barry McStay, and each week I, my co-host and our guest, propose our candidates for the title of World's Worst Something. Now, this week I was fairly sure I had the strongest candidate for our World's Worst. It's obviously the Blackwall 330-litre. It's a big hulking plastic black monstrosity, sticks out like a sore thumb, and its sales page boasts of it having a wide aperture, an extra wide hatch, and a windproof lid, which sounds absolutely filthy and sounds like the exact sort of boast people make up because a product doesn't actually have any redeeming features. And then Ben informed me I'd misread the topic and we aren't doing World's Worst Composter, but World's Worst Composer this week. But listen up, Blackwall, I'm coming for you. Just you wait. Anyway, alongside me, shaking his baton around in a frankly alarming fashion, it's the doors to my handle, the nothing to my hiding, and the get to my back, Ben Vandeveld. It's the John Cage version of Ben Vandeveld this week. There you go.
Yeah, I thought I'd just do a little recital of the first 10 seconds of John Cage's most famous work.
Yes.
Just because it's just what I play it beautifully.
And I love that man monetized dead air.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. He is the answer to every bit of awkward improv ever.
Yeah. He's probably the most famous contemporary composer going, just purely for...
Well, to be fair, let us not get ahead of ourselves, because I'm obviously going to talk about him a bit on the show. And do you know what? I'm going to get in there very early and say I spent a lot of time looking at minimalist composers or modern composers or avant-garde composers. And every time I'd start reading about them and go, what absolute stuff and nonsense are you throwing at me now that you're claiming is music? And after 5 minutes of reading about them, I'd go, but they influenced the musical palette of Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey. And I'd be like, all right, fine, you're a legitimate musician as well. Next.
Yeah, it turns out
composers tend to know what music is.
It turns out they do. You're relatively musical, aren't you?
I'm the sort of person who got up to grade 5 in piano and essentially hated doing grades and scales and wanted to be good at sight reading, and after 3 years of learning had discovered I wasn't good at sight reading, so just gave up doing piano lessons.
Okay, so an impatient composer.
An impatient composer. Yes. All of my music would be written in, like, semi-quavers. I have no time for breves.
Okay, well, before we expose our lack of scholarship any further, we should probably introduce a grown-up to the podcast.
Oh, go on, then.
Our guest this week is a junior research fellow in music at Christ Church College, Oxford, an award-winning music historian and writer who is staggeringly overqualified for the next hour of her life. Her work has focused on 20th century theatre music in Nordic countries and Britain, and how music was involved in the attempt to build a people's theatre in Sweden. Her defining thesis, ABBA the Musical and its impact on social democracy in Malmo, is quite the page-turner.
Oh, come on. If I'm going to write that, at least call it, like, the abattoir. Music in danger. Come on. Can we rewind?
We have peaked with the best pun of the show 5 minutes in. And for once, it's not you, McStay, who's decimated it. Much of...
For our listeners, our guest also has a dog in the background.
Sorry about my dog.
No, she's just a very experimental composer.
Yeah.
This is my John Cage moment, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You kind of muzzle him.
No, you don't use a muzzle on him, you'll just use a trombone mute.
Yeah.
I can get him to sing. There we go.
Much of our guest's work focuses on composers on the margins of society, whereas we suspect much of ours will be on those who scribbled on the margins of their manuscript and thought, yeah, that'll probably do. Her first real book, Quartet, is a group biography of 4 women composers who have been otherwise overlooked by history: Ethel Smythe, Rebecca Clark, Dorothy Howell, and Doreen Carwithen. It's impossible to overlook her, though, as she's bringing some proper scholarship and daft stories to the show. It's the harmonious, melodious, canine-assisted Leia Broad.
That's maybe the longest introduction I've ever had. Thank you. It makes me sound very professional.
We should really be calling it an overture, shouldn't we?
Yes, we should. Let's be honest, Leia. The start and the end of that made you sound professional. The middle, not so much.
Rude. How dare you?
Yeah, to be honest, I can't get over how layered the joke of an abattoir being of a Swedish pop-based conservatoire that is full of hanging meat that they have tuned to the chromatic scale.
That's my next book.
How musical would you say you are? Because you write about music quite a lot.
Well, that's a very personal question. No, I mean, I play the piano. I think I'm less practiced than I used to be. So I'd say, like, middling musical, but most of the time I think of myself more as a historian now than, like, a practicing musician.
Because I wondered if you know, some people, when they translate old texts from, like Greek tragedies into English, or like Chekhov into English these days, sometimes you get, like, playwrights doing it who don't necessarily speak the original language. Mm. And I'm wondering if, as a historian of composers and musicians, do you find having a musical ear and musical ability gives you an extra insight into their language and what your subjects might have been going through at a certain period of their lives and so on?
It certainly gives me strong opinions about the music that I write about. Whether or not they're right, I don't know. But, like, I think it does change things to be able to sit down and go, okay, I'm going to play through this piece. I'm going to kind of work at it from the inside out and try and get into it, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
I think it does make a difference. And I really enjoy playing.
Like, obviously, you can read music, but are you able to do what people used to do in the 30s and 40s before the pop charts did, and just sit down with a nice manuscript and read it like a book?
So I'm a little bit in the I wanted to be a good sight reader camp.
Yes.
I sympathise so hard with that situation.
They're teaching it wrong.
Yeah. So I mean, like, I can usually hear piano music in my head, but, like, if you sit me down with a big orchestral score, I mean, I really need to, like, hear that or play it through on the piano to work it out. I can't hear it in my head. It's just too many lines, too many notes.
To be fair, people who are able to read an entire orchestral score at once are gifted beyond belief. It's like trying to read 5 books at once.
Yeah, hats off to them. I don't know how conductors do it, where they sit down and, you know, you can see them, like, reading it like I read a normal book, and then they'll just be like, trombones, you're late, and you'll go, what? I don't know, this is crazy. So yeah, that is a gift I wish I had.
Maybe they're not doing it. Maybe they just sit there, but then they just trust that the orchestral people will come in at the correct moment. Just, like,
the trombones are usually late.
Trombones are usually late, yeah, exactly.
Obviously, we have discovered that you are hugely musically and historically talented, but what is it, Leia, that you are worst at in the world?
So I took a long time thinking about this. It turns out I have quite a long list of things I'm bad at. But I think probably the thing I am uniquely worst in the world at is feeding ducks. Weren't expecting that, were you?
you know you don't need to use a knife and fork, just to be clear.
Oh, it's almost as bad.
Face the jury and admit to us what you have done to some ducks, Leia.
I don't think I should. No, so, like, I went on a date, and this guy... I know it's a bad start.
Was his name Daffy?
No, I wish. No, it's Donald, actually. Oh, yeah. And no, so we went on this date and he had invited me to go and feed ducks. And I thought, oh, that's so cute. Usually people ask you to go for coffee or whatever. Mm-hmm. This is a bit more original. And I don't know, I'd read somewhere that it was bad to feed bread to ducks because it like swells up inside. So you feed them peas instead. I was at work. I was quite busy. I didn't really think this through. So I just bought some frozen peas. And this guy just turned up and was like, why are you cannonballing ducks with frozen peas? So all the ducks ran away and it was really sad. And I felt very aggrieved that they didn't appreciate the lengths I'd gone to buy them some frozen peas. Aww. So unfortunately...
I'm really glad that it was just frozen peas and you just hadn't turned up with a can of the Jolly Green Giant's Best and started lobbing tins of peas at mallards.
When you say you were cannonballing them, were you firing the peas from like a little catapult at these ducks?
Well, you know, it just turns out you can hit ducks quite well.
I'll be honest, I think that the symphony for pea shooter and duck, if it hasn't been written already, should now be made.
Yeah. That should be a project.
Yeah. Well, maybe ducks should be like, you know, those guitarists who, you know, use the guitar as a percussion instrument as well as a melodic one. So you could hit the ducks' arses to make them quack, but also sort of like ping their beak as well.
So I did not think that this would turn into a podcast on animal cruelty. I'm so sorry. I feel like I should take this back now. Like, I'm not bad at feeding ducks. I'm bad at something else.
This week's episode is a Patreon suggestion from our long-standing donor, Kayla Bazana, and our long-suffering donor. Kayla suggested the idea of doing World's Worst Composer, I reckon, over a year ago at this point. Yep. And we have been hunting high and low to find the right guest and the right time. And goddammit, there's no pressure on you, Leia, but... if Kayla withdraws her funding off the back of us finally getting a bad episode in the can.
We asked, I think, three other composers and academics, and each of them very politely got back to us going, we like the podcast very much, but we would feel absolutely awful choosing a worst composer. We just think it's not our place to make that decision on our colleagues and compatriots and the musical ancestors that go before us, whereas Leia, clearly an amoral musical historian, who's like, right.
Now you tell me I'm that bitch.
So, to begin with, I've already mentioned John Cage's 4 minutes 33 seconds, which is, it's a bit of a running joke on this show, because it is very funny for those that haven't heard episodes where we've talked about it. The composer John Cage wrote a silent piece of music that is meant to last 4 minutes and 33 seconds. It is actually in 3 movements, which I'm sure if you listen closely, you can hear. The inspiration for it was that in 1951... he visited something called an anechoic chamber at Harvard University. I've actually been in one of these. They are fascinating spaces. They are like the most insulated chambers you can imagine, so full of spiky foam. Cage reported something that I felt. He said, you would think that you would not hear anything, but he said he heard 2 sounds, one high and one low. And when he asked the engineer what they were, he told him that the high one was his nervous system operating and the low one was his blood circulating around his body.
Wow.
It's really weird. I didn't hear the high one. I just heard the weird thump of my pulse.
And so he, yeah, because the whole deal with 433 is that it's, you're meant to listen to the sounds of the room that the orchestra are in, not playing or whatever.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah. Did you know, guys, that John Cage is also a rip-off artist? He is not, by any stretch of the imagination, the first composer to write silent music. In 1896, Edgardo del Valle de Paz published Il Silenzio, and apparently he was humorously critiquing various avant-garde techniques of the time. Next, there is the brilliantly named Funeral March for the Auspices of a Deaf Man by Alphonse Allais, which consists of 24 blank measures of music. It is described as an incoherent funeral march. Apparently, the notation that he wrote on there is that it is the job of the performers to occupy themselves solely with counting out the bars. So you can't just sit there. You've got to look at it. You've got to turn the pieces of the manuscript over.
Yeah. Oh, nice. That is my favourite bit of every time an orchestra now plays 433, is at one point the conductor will sort of do a little gesture and they'll all very smugly reach over and turn over their sheet music.
Yeah. Well, there are different ways of doing this. So Erwin Schulhoff in 1919 wrote In Futurum, which is silent but notated in great rhythmic detail. So it's full of really weird time signatures and intricate rhythmic patterns, just no melody. And then the last one is Silent Music by Raymond Scott from 1941, in which instead of people just sitting there letting the silence happen, they all fingered the holes of their brass instruments or rhythmically swished the bow of all the string instruments, but again, didn't make contact or blow any air through them.
That's great.
I found just a couple of other examples of silent music in more popular music. Stiff Records in 1980 released The Wit and Wisdom of Ronald Reagan. And side one was the wit, and side two was the wisdom, and both sides were silent. Michael Viner released This Feels Like a Goon Show Joke. He released The Best of Marcel Marceau. Brilliantly, there's a sort of preppy funk band called Wolfpack, who are great fun. They released some really cool tracks. But in 2014, they released an album onto Spotify called Sleepify. And it consisted of 10 tracks of silence. However, it still generated $20,000 worth of royalties in 2 months of periods. And they basically exposed a loophole in the streaming services royalty calculation model. Because it wasn't any music, it was just dead air.
Oh my God, Ben, we should stop talking right now. It seems to be a better way of making money.
And my favourite title of silent music, this is by an artist called Kid 606, and the song is titled Dramatic Pause of Silence to Signify the End of the Album and Beginning of Additional Songs Included on the CD to Make People Feel Better About Buying the CD instead of the vinyl version. Next, a little look at the other end of rather not necessarily cacophonous music, but music that resulted in a riot. Yeah, now like, I think we've talked about the Rite of Spring before, haven't we? That's probably the most infamous one. Stravinsky, as far as I know, tried to score a collection of folk dancers, and a lot of it was very discordant, and there was a ballet that went with it that was also very modernist, and people were so shocked by this, they ripped up their chairs and threw them at the stage.
Well, there was clearly some kind of disturbance, but sometimes, like, you know, composers and performers were very aware of the effects of negative publicity and so would often, like, encourage their friends to kick up a bit of a stink. And also, in this case, it was probably more the choreography than the music that was really controversial, because it was the choreography that was really angular and was going against what was thought of as the ballet at the time, which was all very beautiful and tutus. That is not what the Rite of Spring was doing. But it's partly Stravinsky's music that does make the ballet as controversial as it is. So yeah, complicated, but sort of.
Good. No, listen, I wish I could explain truly to the listeners the facial expression you pulled as I started getting my academia wrong there. It was looking like, oh, you're really trying there, aren't you, little man?
The other thing I'm really bad at is lying. I find that out very fast.
Well, Leia, me and Barry would like to induct you into the Worst Foot Forward Poker School after this podcast is concluded.
Yeah, thanks.
The ones that I found, there's a piece of music called Hyperprism by a chap called Edgard Varese. Not only did the audience hiss at the conclusion, but they laughed throughout.
Were they snakes and hyenas?
Well, my favourite thing is, once it finished, someone got on stage and urged the audience to take the work seriously, which in my experience never works. And to emphasise that, they then asked them to stay while the orchestra repeated the piece again.
No!
There's a great review of Varese's piece by a chap called William James Henderson, who said, "It remained for Varese to shatter the calm of a Sabbath night, to cause peaceful lovers of music to scream out their agony, to arouse angry emotions and tempt men to retire to the back of the theatre and perform timpani concertos on each other's faces."
This is one of my favourite things about researching 20th century music, is the amount of critical invective about new music, where they could be so rude and you're like, wow, okay, you just like no holds barred. They're like, this is trash and this is trash and you are a horrible person.
Yeah.
Like, wow, okay.
To be fair to him, when you read what made up the orchestra, just see how this escalates. Flutes, clarinets, three horns, two trumpets, tenor and bass trombones, a snare drum, an Indian drum, a tambourine, a Chinese cymbal, an anvil, a slapstick, two Chinese blocks, a lion's roar, a big rattle, sleigh bells, and a siren.
Oh, piss off, mate. Just use the orchestra, will you?
The final sort of modern composer I looked at was a chap called Steve Reich, who...
love Steve Reich.
He might be great, but he once performed a piece of music called Four Organs at Carnegie Hall. And the conservative audience tried yelling and sarcastically applauding to hasten the end of the piece. And that sort of led to sort of like a real sort of Jets and Sharks moment in Carnegie Hall. One of the performers, a chap called Michael Tilson Thomas, recalls, "One woman walked down the aisle and began repeatedly banging her head on the front of the stage whilst wailing, 'Stop, stop, I confess.'"
But that's the sort of people who go to Carnegie Hall. Steve Reich is absolutely brilliant. His work is he tears apart chords and music and looks at it from an interesting way. A lot of his stuff is based on mathematics and symmetrical principles and things like that. Actually, Four Organs is really quite good.
You're not welcome on this podcast, apparently.
Yeah.
Get out.
No, but I really enjoy people reacting badly to music they don't like, like unreasonably badly to music they don't like.
Those are the two ends of the spectrum I went to, of very, very quiet and very, very loud and angry. And then I've just got a list of terrible humans left. So this guy is probably the most morally repugnant person that we've spoken about. I remember it might have been for Worst Painter, Barry, you talked about Caravaggio and how obviously...
Yes.
Remarkable painter, but an astonishing murderous shit.
Caravaggio, great painter, absolute shit. Yeah.
Yeah. So
that's the title of my upcoming art history book.
So there is a Neapolitan composer and prince called Carlo Gesualdo.
I already don't like him just from his surname.
Yeah.
He's Gesualdo.
Gesualdo, yeah. You can hear the cape and sabre, can't you?
Yeah. And the twirly mustache.
Yeah. So he was, I think, genuinely quite groundbreaking in the sort of music he made. It's quite dissonant. And I imagine if you were listening in the 1600s, it might be a little bit freaky for you. But it's, to my very untrained ear, it's good music. But he is best known not for his music, but for the violent murder of his first wife, who committed adultery with a cross-dressing duke. So, you know, not only a murderer, the guy's transphobic as well. His second wife accused his own two lovers of witchcraft, and they were then tried for murder.
Sorry. I'm just hearing that there was a second wife after he'd murdered the first wife.
Yes, who then accused him of having affairs.
Okay.
What can I say? The guy was a pioneer in discord, and clearly he walked the walk and talked the talk. He was a method composer. And this is where it gets possibly apocryphal, but one of the women confessed under torture that she had been advised by Gesualdo to take a slice of bread, place it into her womb, and saturate it with her menstrual blood so that he could then eat it.
Huh?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah, guys.
That's taken a left turn.
Yeah, it really has, isn't it? So, oh. Guys, Leia has brought out a whole new symphony of facial expressions.
My womb has just gone into retreat. Like, what the hell?
Just, wow.
Yeah. I mean, he was, like, clearly, as well as being a shit, psychotic and mentally unstable to the extreme.
I think that, let's not kink shame. Dude killed his wife. That's the real problem.
That's the real problem, yes.
Let's just...
You're absolutely right. If you want to be into weird, demonic sex parties, you do you.
Did you say it was a slice of bread?
Yeah.
It's not a loaf, at least.
It's not a loaf, but, I mean, how does it... Surely a baguette is more practical.
No, he was Italian. He will have used focaccia. It's more absorbent.
Oh, yeah. Okay, of course. Yes.
Why did other people turn down coming on the podcast?
Highest standards of scholarship, Leia.
But it will be some scholar somewhere taking themselves very seriously who unearthed all of that. So, yeah, you know, be grateful.
To be fair, yeah.
Yeah, no, that is...
That's a journal article right there.
Yes.
Gesualdo ended his days afflicted by an imaginary horde of demons who, he said, the torments only ceased if a dozen young men beat him violently three times a day. Don't kink shame. Oh. Don't kink shame.
Right.
I was going to say, we all have those problems sometimes. It's okay, Gesualdo, don't you?
Yeah.
Now that is a jury duty job. Who are the dozen young men this week?
Yeah. 12 very angry men.
Yeah.
It is believed but not confirmed that one of these masochistic frenzies was the cause of his death. And right. There's a really interesting conundrum and paradox here that many academics have talked about, that basically, if he hadn't committed such shocking acts, his musical achievements may well have just been a footnote in history and not known about. Because he did these horrible crimes, we know about the music. So it's, this is not a, ooh, is the suffering worth the music? No, obviously not. I'd quite like his wife to be alive. Well, not now, that'd be horrifying. But but yeah, it's a real tricky one. So, you know, genuinely pioneering musician, but awful shit.
Yeah.
Thank you, Otto.
He disagrees, clearly. He's got opinions on this.
My choice for world's worst composer is an eccentric British lord called Gerald Hugh Tyrwhitt Wilson, the 14th Baron Berners. He lived from 1883 to 1950 and was friends with a remarkable collection of individuals, including Stravinsky, Salvador Dali, and H.G. Wells. He was brought up by his extremely religious mother and grandmother. His musical interests as a child were ignored, and his mother instead tried to develop his masculinity. He was a real dandy. He looks phenomenal. It's sort of, you know, the guy in Dad's Army with the spivvy moustache who's selling stuff on the black market?
Yes.
He's got that sort of look about him.
Oh, yeah, he does. I just looked it up.
He was a talented musician. He's also quite the eccentric. For example, he used to capture pigeons and then take them to his house in Farringdon and dye them vibrant colours before releasing them back into London.
Why?
Why not?
When you've
got inherited wealth, you've got to pass the days before death somehow, don't you?
When a man is tired of London, he must start painting its pigeons to pass the time.
He even, and this is unforgivable, he decorated his house with joke notices, including epithets like "mangling done here," "no dogs admitted above the stairs," "prepare to meet thy god," painted inside a wardrobe. All of his dogs wore pearl necklaces.
Yes, I love him.
He owned a Rolls-Royce automobile that contained a small clavichord keyboard inside it.
Nice.
Is that where he did his composing?
Some of it, clearly. He used to drive around his estate in it wearing a pig's head mask to frighten the locals. And at the entrance of his estate, there was a 100-foot viewing tower known as the Farringdon Folly. And at the entrance of the Farringdon Folly, it read, "Members of the public committing suicide from this tower do so at their own risk." Which, to be fair, is a banger of a joke.
That is quite funny.
His music, which was, again, very avant-garde. He wrote it in the 1920s. That was the style. They're very odd. Probably his, one of his most infamous works is a funeral march for a rich aunt, which was written in 1914, and there was nothing remotely funereal about it, because it skips along giggling and guffawing musically. And basically, you can hear the joke of it, him just going, I'm rich, he's dead, and I'm rich. Berners himself, talking about his music, said he would have been a better composer if he had accepted fewer lunch invitations. English composer Gavin Bryars responded by saying, if he had spent more time on his music, he could have become a duller composer.
That's great.
But basically, Stravinsky described him as an amateur, and he wasn't quite a Florence Foster Jenkins, but he was sort of like the weird kid at the back of the class that all the real important artists of the 20th century kept around to amuse themselves. He even wrote a ballet called The Triumph of Neptune, based on a story by Sacheverell Sitwell, who I believe was related to our favourite knight, Sir George Sitwell, inventor of the wasp gun. So he's not worst in terms of morally, he's not worst in terms of aesthetically. Everything about him is farcical.
I prefer him being our heralded failure rather than the guy who was having womb jam on his toast. So that'll be fine for me, thanks.
Yeah, I think Womb Jam is a Hawkwind album.
Yeah, probably is. Right, Leah, let's bring some scholarly vigour.
I'm deeply regretting my life choices. As a fan of the avant-garde, and I have a guilty confession, I've performed John Cage's 4:33, so I'm feeling very personally attacked right now.
On your, as solo or as part of an orchestra?
As a soloist.
Okay, yes, of course. Yeah. Why pay everyone else to be there?
Right. I've done quite a bit of John Cage's stuff, actually.
What was the room you were in?
It was a hall. Yeah, it was part of an experimental concert, and I've done some of John Cage's music for prepared piano in a art gallery. I've done some very weird experimental stuff in a cathedral. Like, it's good fun.
That's great.
I strongly recommend.
Did during 4:33 the audience sort of start giggling nervously? Because that all the YouTube videos I've seen of it being performed sort of eventually culminate the audience sort of being...
No, it was worse than that. I got the giggles because the audience was too serious.
Oh, I bet Cage would love that.
Yeah.
And it was very hard because there was this guy in the front row, and he clearly looked like he was having a moment, like a spiritual moment there. And it was a bit distracting, actually, for the performer. So it's very inconsiderate. It was really good fun. The one with the audience, they did start laughing. We did a John Cage piece for radios, 12, 13 people, all with their own radios. And you have your score and you like change the frequency on the radio according to where you are in the score. And you have your conductor. And that did get a range of responses from the audience.
Are you tuning it to like ranges where it's just static, or are you tuning it to like sometimes channels and things?
It depends. Yeah, where you land, really. For the premiere of this piece, which really cracks me up, they had not realised that at the time it was premiered, broadcast stopped before the time of the premiere. So they were all just sitting there in silence, twiddling their transistors. John Cage freaking loved it. So like, he's like, yes, this just shows indeterminacy is everywhere, kind of thing. That was the piece that was good fun. So I feel I can't go down the avant-garde being terrible composers. I'm sorry.
That's fair. As I think all of us discovered in researching this, there is a very broad field to pick from, even if you discount the avant-garde. So
yeah, so I'm surprised we've not mentioned Wagner yet, actually. I'm expecting him to come up at some point.
Tell us a bit about Wagner, because musically people are sort of rhapsodized about what the experience of listening to a full-blown Wagner opera and so on.
He's a really complicated figure, right? Like his music is incredibly progressive. It's extremely important for understanding like the history of that period. So many people were influenced by him, both in the theatre and musically. Having said that, the guy is a raging anti-Semite. Mm. Like, even for his time, he's extreme. He writes extremely problematically about Judaism and music, and he has some really vitriolic and unpleasant and dangerous views. So he, for me, is one of these composers where I think people's enthusiasm for his music can underplay some of his really problematic political and historical legacies as well. So for me, he sits in one of these places where I'm like, well, the music you wrote is extremely interesting, but morally, I have some questions.
Yes.
as we're discovering, that happens a lot in classical music history.
Yeah. We often say it's like the Hitler of the podcast. Hitler could be the answer to so many of the topics we talk about in the podcast, and we just never bother putting him in because it's just too easy.
Yeah, so this is why I have not gone for him, because what's the point?
Yeah.
The one that, for me, I find him fascinating is this guy, a Czech composer called František Kocvara. And so he's an 18th century composer. And for me, he is the worst composer for a number of reasons, one of which is like he's a real one-hit wonder. He writes this piece called The Battle of Prague, which is super, 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 super famous, but also famous because it's so dreadful. And like it gets parodied and absolutely ripped apart by some quite famous people. It's really dreadful. And like, I don't like to go out there judging people's compositions because I am not a good composer myself. Let's be real. But this is dreadful stuff. Like, it's really appalling. Because he's such a one-hit wonder, he really becomes more famous because of the way he died rather than anything he actually did, even though he has this one popular piece.
I was going to say, was this particular piece popular in his own lifetime as well? Yeah.
Okay, so this piece is a piano piece called The Battle of Prague, and it like basically spawns a genre of battle pieces, which are musical depictions of battles and their subsequent victories. And so this piece is written around 1788, and it becomes wildly popular. Like every single person who plays the piano plays the Battle of Prague. It runs into multiple editions in America, in London, on the continent. Like it's really famous. I mean, so it starts out with like a march, and then you get all the cannons in the bass. So you're like sitting here playing your little melody, and then you just be like smacking the bass of the piano to make the sound of cannons. And then you have the Lament of the Dying, which is very, very weird. and you have all these like battle noises, and it just goes on forever. And it's awful, but ultimately is extremely influential. And there's this point where like everybody in the early 19th century, late 18th century, like, you know, the Battle of Prague, your aunt plays the Battle of Prague, your sister plays the Battle of Prague, and you cannot escape.
The Battle of Prague will come for you.
Yeah, really. He's quite socially interesting, particularly because, so I came across him researching Emily Bronte. She played the Battle of Prague and had the music for the Battle of Prague. Jane Austen would have also played the Battle of Prague. Like it would have been mainly women who were playing these pieces. So he is actually like surprisingly interesting because he ends up writing this work that a lot of women would have played. It's, you know, obviously women aren't fighting, but it is a way in which they're like involved in civil discussions about war. And this is one way that they do so is through performing these like battle pieces. And they're quite virtuosic in some ways because you're using all the like latest techniques to make the sounds of battles. They're quite difficult to play. So you have to be quite a good pianist.
Is this a pro-war piece or an anti-war piece or just a war is a thing and we're going to explore that via music piece?
This is a kind of pro-victory piece rather than a pro-battle piece per se. But certainly like in the American Civil War, it's seen as a very patriotic thing that women can do to play like these battle pieces at home with their children. And so that is then a very patriotic thing. Some women begin to write battle pieces as well. So he's like surprisingly influential in a genre of dreadful music. So I think he earns some kudos for being the worst composer for not only like writing bad music, but spawning more bad music. That gets some kudos.
It's like the Red Hot Chili Peppers are influential for making Limp Bizkit and Linkin Park possible.
Yeah.
So, and I was reading like contemporary accounts of this piece and people hated it so much. So Mark Twain really, really freaking hated the Battle of Prague. In one of his books, he writes about this woman who he sees playing the Battle of Prague. And I'm going to have to read you a couple of these because they're so good. And he's like, so this woman, without any more preliminaries, she turned on all the horrors of the Battle of Prague, that venerable chivalry, and waded chin deep in the blood of the slain. She made a fair and honourable average of 2 false notes in every 5. But her soul was in arms, so she never stopped to correct herself. None of us like mediocrity, but we all reverence perfection. This girl's music was perfection in its way. It was the very worst music that had ever been achieved on our planet by a mere human being.
Whoa.
Okay. That's quite bad. And there's another one where the protagonist, he hates musical women at all. And the reason given, so he says, a woman who played on the piano was an evil thing in Jack's eyes, and his horror of any other instrument was not less in its intensity. But he had his excuses. Once, he possessed a grandmother who played the Battle of Prague on the piano every evening. And though he was but a child at the time, he had neither forgotten nor forgiven her. So, I say, this piece was really disdained by like people who considered themselves to have elite musical taste at the time. It was considered super gauche, and yet it's wildly, wildly popular.
This bit aside, him sort of writing the birdie song, how did he die? Because I sort of noticed you said he's famous for how he died.
So he's famous for dying in one of the first recorded cases of erotic asphyxiation. So even though he's written this dreadful piece that spawns a dreadful genre, he is still more famous for dying in an unfortunate situation with a prostitute.
Oh, wow.
Apparently he first asked her to castrate him, and then she was like, nope, no, I'm not doing that. So he's like, okay, well, will you hang me then? So she's like, yeah, okay, but, and he gives her a time limit. And unfortunately, the time limit that he gave this prostitute was too long. He dies. So it goes to trial because she's sued for manslaughter to try and like discourage people from repeating the situation. And apparently she just like ran out on the street saying, I've hung a man, but I think I hung him for too long. And I'm afraid now that he's dead. So she clearly was like fine with this situation. But the problem was that he died rather than it being enjoyable for everybody.
Where did you say it happened? Was that in London, did you say?
Yeah, London in 1791.
Oh, yeah, wow. And she was acquitted of the crimes, and she very shrewdly cashed in on her ordeal by publishing her memoirs, along with a copy of the trial transcript, and they were reprinted in a pamphlet with a hell of a name. This pamphlet was titled Modern Propensities, or An Essay on the Art of Strangling.
Yep. Wow. And it goes into like a lot of detail about the various different ways that you can make orgasms more intense. And it gets quite grisly because a lot of it, this like belief that hanging will intensify your orgasm came from like seeing hung people ejaculate. Right. And it turns out, I ended up doing a bit of medical research for this podcast, and it turns out that this is not the case. It's to do with like your spinal cord being snapped. And it's not very nice. Ooh. Yeah, it's not great. I'm not going to go there because I know I said it was not suitable for work, but it gets quite grisly.
Yeah.
But there's this like fascination with altering or in some way intensifying sexual experiences. And this is where this pamphlet comes from. And Kotzvara becomes kind of like an apocryphal anti-hero. So yeah.
Yeah, did you say her name?
Susanna Hill is the name of the woman involved.
I just looked the story up now, you said, and she lived on Vine Street, which I think we've talked about when we talked about the we did our walk around the Monopoly board episode, and Vine Street is one of the orange properties on the London Monopoly board, along with Bow Street and Marlborough Street. They're all formerly associated with the law because they all had police stations on them at one point in time. This Vine Street's a little street between Piccadilly and Regent Street. And it's also one of the first cases of autoerotic association. The Marquess of Queensbury was charged at Vine Street Police Station with libel against Oscar Wilde, which led to Wilde's shaming and at trial. So it has a sort of an important place in two great British sex scandals of sorts. Oh, nice. Well, I like that you've brought both, you know, musical reasons for Kotzvara being a terrible composer and also hilarious sexual reasons.
Well, you know, he wants to do what he wants to do, but I just feel really sorry for this guy that, like, he tried his best to be a composer. He wrote, like, he played a whole load of instruments. He was employed in the King's Theatre Orchestra. He was clearly, like, a relatively okay performer, but his compositions that aren't the Battle of Prague just get completely forgotten. They're really bad. Like, they're so forgettable. And the Battle of Prague is only memorable because it's so dreadful, and then only anybody knows him for like the fact that he died. And there's even like there's a comedy episode where he makes a appearance. It's got it's a weird series called like Sick Note,
right,
with Nick Frost and Rupert Grint in it.
Oh,
and there's an episode named after him. And again, it's because of the way he died, not because of the fact that he was a bad composer. And I just, that's got to hurt.
You don't have any control over how history will remember you. I mean, he maybe had a little bit of control of don't ask a hooker to cut off your penis and then hang you.
And bless him as well for dying in 1791, because that's the same year Mozart died, I think.
It's just all very tragic.
They've gone down in history for very different reasons.
Are you saying that this guy is the Mother Teresa to Mozart's Lady Diana?
Princess Diana, yes.
Do not condone this.
Now, I think that's a very much my takeaway from Leah's research.
Oh gosh, what have I done? I guess you can't control the way people use your research. So yeah. Exactly.
I looked mainly at quite well-known composers because I sort of figured, knowing Ben, he would go and look for the esoteric. Knowing Leah, where you were coming from, Leah, I thought there'd be a very academic deep dive into one specific person. So I thought I'd do a sort of a broad spread of names people knew, and just found some interesting / tragic facts about various composers. Both Handel and Bach went blind towards the end of their lives, both of them at the hands of the same eye surgeon. Apparently.
Oh, so it was medical malpractice.
The article I read has the word, he was called an oculist, but even that's in inverted commas. The Chevalier John Taylor. And according to Daniel Albert, the author of Men of Vision, A History of Ophthalmology, he says Taylor was the poster child for 18th century quackery. And the book has an entire chapter on his career. Handel had declining vision for the last decade of his life after Taylor carried out a cataract surgery, which basically involved shoving the cataract back into the back of the eye.
No, thank you.
It was a procedure called couching. And Bach, he had a couple of goes at having surgery to cure his failing eyesight and got a post-operative infection. It seems likely that Taylor was the cause of his death, actually. He was treated with laxatives and bleeding as a result of this infection and was blind while he dictated his last work. Taylor, he's like Pirelli in Sweeney Todd. He would show up in town and make a big show of his like medical miracles. He would draw crowds and get them to watch the procedures in the town square. There'd be like placards and handbills and signs painted on the side of his coach and eyeballs. And the motto, qui dat videre dat vivere, he who gives sight gives life, painted on the side of it. And so there'd be big hoo-ha about his arrival. And then he'd perform the procedures in public and leave town before the patients took their bandages off their eyes. Arnold Schoenberg, he was a very influential classical composer of the last century. He had a deep-seated fear of the number 13, triskaidekaphobic. A lot of people who are superstitious about 13, one of the reasons that superstition exists is that 12 is such a perfect number in the human world. Like, there's 12 months in the year, there's 12 hours in the clock, there's 12 zodiac signs, traditionally.
And the way it divides so satisfyingly by 1, 2, 3, 4, 6 and itself.
Yes, as well as which 13 is associated with the Last Supper, 13 people being present, Judas sometimes being referred to as the 13th person to sit down. And Schoenberg, he has an opera, Moses und Aaron, and Aaron only has one A in it, because the title would have had 13 letters in it. Hmm. He'd spelt it with two A's. So that's how out of his way he would go to avoid the number 13. But God bless him. On Friday the 13th, July 1951, 76-year-old Arnold Schoenberg spent the entire day in bed so terrified and convinced that something terrible was going to happen to him. And at 12:45, his wife was sitting downstairs in the house, and she looked at the clock and said to herself, another 1/4 hour and then the worst will be over and he'll be able to relax. And then the doctor who was attending Arnold called her and he died on Friday the 13th.
Oh, no.
And he's 76, which if you add it up...
adds up to 13.
So he was right. He was right all along. You mock him, but fuck.
Yeah. Edvard Grieg, the Norwegian composer of Peer Gynt and various other things, lived in a house in an area called Troll Valley, apparently. The local children called it Troll Valley, so he called his house Troll Hill. He was quite famous in his lifetime, Grieg, so a lot of people came to visit his house. One time a little girl came to visit Troll Hill and asked him if he had any toys. And he said that he kept a troll on his little nightstand beside the bed and a pig. And then his wife, Nina, said that Edvard used to pat them on the head and said goodnight to them before going to sleep every evening. Don't know if that bit's true, but she said it in front of this little girl. And this little girl thought this was so adorable that she offered Grieg her pet, which was a little doll of a frog made from cloth. And Grieg accepted that and carried around with him in his pocket for the rest of his life. And every time he gave a public concert, he used to pat the frog on the head and say good luck to it. Presumably because the frog was playing in the brass section. but that's a nice, cute story.
I like Grieg. He's been like a genuinely nice dude.
Yeah, a lot of people sort of talk about meeting him and him being generally quite a nice person.
Quite sweet. The other composer who's super like that is Vaughan Williams, who just seems to have been like the nicest guy on the planet and absolutely adored his cats, really loved his cats.
Yes.
So Doreen Carwithan, the woman who I'm writing the book about, she had to go and see him they were working on a film together, and he invites her around for tea, and he always served the first slice of cake to his cat. And so his cat gets cake, and it's just so cute. And there are some lovely photos of Vaughan Williams with his cat, and he just seems to have been like a really supportive, genuinely nice guy. And you can't say that for very many people in classical music history. But Vaughan Williams,
he is, I think, my favourite composer. I find his stuff astonishing, and you can see the photos of him. He's got that benevolent granddad thing going on that like David Attenborough and Sir Bobby Robson have.
I know
as soon as we say this, somebody's going to call into the podcast and be like, here's reason why Vaughan Williams is a dreadful human.
Okay, having a moratorium on anyone cancelling Ralph Vaughan Williams.
Yeah. you might be cancelled for calling him Ralph. I think they pronounced it Rafe. Ralph Vaughan Williams doesn't sound like such an impressive composer, actually.
It's actually pronounced Fanshawe.
Yeah. I also really liked Dvorak. A lot of people sort of think it's like very pastoral sounds and traditional Hungarian music being brought to sort of higher levels and all of that. The thing I love about Dvorak is he was born in 1841, so he was growing up a lot in the age of rail. And Dvorak was a bloody train spotter, so he was. Loved a train. He just could not get enough of them. He moved to Prague, and Prague was a big rail hub in Europe at that time. It was the two big important train stations at the time. And he lived within walking distance of Franz Josef I's station. And when he wasn't working, he spent loads of his spare time there. He would chat to the railroad workers. He would leave concerts to watch international express trains departing and arriving. He would memorize the schedules and the arrivals and departure times of trains, and would just noting down trains and describing them in notebooks and things like that. His daughter was dating some student. He asked the student to note the number of an international express train, and then when he got it wrong, he told his daughter he would forbid her to marry him.
Wow.
It was a joke, partly, but I imagine there was a bit of truth in it for Dvorak. And when he went to the United States, he went to Grand Central Station and apparently was very disappointed at the lack of opportunities to watch trains pass one another, the way Grand Central Station is designed. It doesn't have the sort of the in and out that a lot of the European stations do. He also once said that, "I would give all my symphonies for inventing the locomotive."
Oh,
so, I like this version of the podcast, which is like fulsome stories about composers.
Well, I sort of just they're famous for one thing, but actually here they are being dorks.
That's lovely. That is Dvorak living out the lumberjack sketch from Monty Python, isn't it? I didn't want to be a classical composer. I wanted to be a train driver.
Yeah. He told one student that trains consist of many parts created by many different components. Everything has a purpose and role, and the result is amazing. The result was also that, here's maybe the worst foot forward bit, while standing at the Prague train station during a train spotting trip late in his life, he caught a chill and died soon afterwards.
Oh no! So he died.
His love of trains may well have killed him.
It's the Francis Bacon stuffing a chicken all over again.
It is Francis Bacon's frozen chicken all over again. Robert Schumann became a famous composer and poet and artist in his lifetime, but he wanted in his early life to be a pianist. This age in Europe is piano virtuoso is the rock star of their time at this point, and Schumann wanted to be part of that. And there's a story that he invented a device with a cigar box and some wire, which he used to try and stretch his fingers and prop them up while practicing and help strengthen them. And instead, two fingers on his right hand were permanently paralyzed.
Oh, no.
This story, some people question whether it was the device did it, or whether he was already suffering from syphilis anyway. and the device was a finger stretcher to try and restore strength and like help him keep the feeling, and but actually he was going to lose the power in them anyway. Maybe rather than admit he had syphilis to his family, Schumann went, oops, I've injured myself, the cigar box wire machine has done for me.
Well, good news for Schumann is at least his wife was like one of the most famous virtuosi of the day, so like she played all his pieces, made him
Clara
famous.
Is it Clara?
Yeah
I think was she his teacher's, his piano teacher's daughter?
Complicated. Robert Schumann was a lodger at Clara Schumann's dad's, and Clara Schumann's dad was her piano teacher.
Ah, right. Okay. But
because of Clara Schumann, like she was hugely influential for like shaping the classical music canon as we know it today. Mm. She made him like, if his pieces would not be as famous as they are today if it wasn't for her. She was like pretty impressive as a pianist. Yeah.
He was the Bernie Taupin and then she was the Elton John. Beethoven, we all have the popular image of Beethoven with the wild hair and the wild look in his eyes. In 1820, he was arrested for vagrancy after being found wandering around Vienna and peering into windows.
He's just doing a bit of browsing.
No, the police, apparently, he'd gotten drunk and confused and got lost trying to find his way home. And the police arrested him, assuming he was homeless, and his protests of, I am Beethoven, didn't convince them. The constable who arrested him wrote, Herr Commissioner, we have arrested somebody who will give us no peace. He keeps on yelling that he is Beethoven, but he is a bum with no coat and no hat. How many skulls did Haydn have?
Several.
He's got two skulls in his tomb. So he died in 1809 in Vienna. At the burial, two men bribed the gravedigger to cut off his head and give it to them. There were a guy called Joseph Karl Rosenbaum, who was a secretary to the Esterhazy family, who were Haydn's employers, and Johann Nepomuk Petter, governor of the provincial prison of Lower Austria. So these weren't just any old guys. These were people with very well-paid jobs. Rosenbaum was actually quite well-known to Haydn. Essentially, the reason they wanted his head was they were interested in phrenology. The idea that you could get to know somebody's mind from the humps and bumps of their head and their skull. 18 years later, there was a similar attempt to steal Beethoven's skull. Again, they just wanted to know, what makes a genius tick? Surely the cranial anatomy will tell us. So the gravedigger, whose name was Jacob Demuth, stole the head. Already due to the hot weather, it had decomposed considerably.
Oh no.
So Rosenbaum apparently vomited as he delivered it to the hospital for dissection.
The vomiting gravedigger, that sounds like an aria, doesn't it?
Yeah.
A silent one.
Now, Petter, the governor of this prison, he took possession of the skull and he showed it to visitors and he kept it apparently in a very nice wooden box with a golden lyre imprinted on the top and little glass windows in it. At some point after that, he gave it back to Rosenbaum, and then the Esterhazys heard of what had happened. Prince was absolutely furious when he discovered that Haydn's remains were missing a skull, figured out who was responsible. Somehow, they managed to fob him off with a fake skull. This was installed into Haydn's tomb instead of the one that was stolen.
Anton Bruckner as well, was very odd in very many ways that we don't have time to go into. He was present when Franz Schubert's coffin was opened in 1888. I'll level with you. Don't know why it was opened. But Bruckner was apparently so overcome with awe that he reached in and grasped Schubert's skull with both hands, refusing to let go. In fact, he only let go when he was physically pulled away from the skull. He clearly had a thing about it because he'd done the same thing a few months earlier with Beethoven's corpse.
One little detail I enjoyed, when the Esterhazys sent agents to search Rosenbaum's house for the skull, Rosenbaum hid the skull in his bed, and his wife Therese lay on the bed and claimed to be menstruating, so the people who came to try and find it didn't search the mattress, which is how they held on to the skull for so long. And it wasn't until 1954 that the real skull was finally returned in this new big marble tomb in a big splendid ceremony. 145 years later, the original skull was restored, but they didn't take the fake skull out, or the wrong skull, so Haydn's tomb now has two skulls in there.
I like the idea of it being so late that he was just sat outside the gates of St. Peter until eventually the correct skull was interred, and St. Peter was like, and now you can go in.
Yeah, you're not allowed in here with that skull. But I want to talk about Hector Berlioz. Perfectly good at writing music. Symphonie Fantastique is lovely. Romantic composer, full of feeling and zest and verve, and very, very emotional in his personal life as well and in his artistic life, shall we say.
That sounds like this kind of like glossed version for his CV. Like, what are your strengths and weaknesses? I'm very passionate about things.
Yeah,
like,
very passionate about music, very passionate about women, it turns out, Berlioz. In 1827, he came across the Irish actress Harriet Smithson. He went to see a production of Hamlet in Paris. For the next few years, basically, he would rent apartments near her. He would write loads of letters to her, which were never responded to, declaring his love for her. He composed Romeo et Juliet and Beatrice et Benedict overtures and Symphonie Fantastique, all for her. Didn't matter that she didn't speak French, by the way, and he didn't speak English. He actually arranged for Symphonie Fantastique to premiere at the same time that Harriet returned to Paris with a show in 1830, but she never came to see the concert, even though he specifically put it on a night where he thought she'd be available. So he gave up on her for a period of time. Eventually, a few years later, he would return to Paris after moving away for a while, rented an apartment in Rue Neuve-Saint-Marc, and discovered that this apartment had just been vacated by one Harriet Smithson. So he was like, oh, it's fate. It just opened up all of the repressed memories all over again. He decided to try again. He arranged another performance of Symphonie Fantastique. This time, Harriet showed up. They married in October 1833. Liszt was one of the witnesses.
Great.
The final sentence of this sort of condenses the rest of her life into about 20 words. They had a son the next year, but argued constantly, then divorced, while poor Harriet's career hit the rocks and she drank herself to death in 1854. Full stop. Berlioz, in 1840, he was separated from Harriet at this point, he fell in love with a singer, Marie Rezio, and he composed Les Nuits d'été, Summer Nights, for her. The one problem, of course, being that Marie was not a very good singer. Her favourite song, Absence, Berlioz said when she sang it, it was like meowing like a dozen cats. But however, despite Berlioz knowing this, he still used his position to get her jobs at the Opéra Comique. It's like someone getting like booking Wembley Stadium for me. And like, it was a complete disaster. It sort of ruined her career. It made people sort of made a bit of a laughing stock of Berlioz as well. However, after Harriet died, they did get married, Berlioz and Marie. And she gave up singing and became his manager instead. And she predeceased him as well. Her mother ended up caring for Berlioz for the rest of his life. So he wasn't very lucky in love. But those two stories aside, my favourite Berlioz love story. In between his first meeting with Harriet Smithson and the second time where they actually got married, he fell for a concert pianist named Marie-Félicité Denise Moquet, or whose name was Camille. And in 1831, lovelorn after Harriet had not shown up at his concert for her, he left France, moved to Rome to be with Camille. The one problem being that when he got there, he discovered Camille had moved to France. And not only that, he was informed by Camille's parents that she was going to marry somebody else, that he wasn't worthy. In fact, she was going to marry a guy who was very wealthy, I think heir to a piano-making fortune or something like that. Not only had Berlioz abandoned the great love of his life in Harriet, or so he thought, to marry this woman, moved country, then discovered that she was marrying somebody else. So he was, shall we say, a little bit emotionally wrought at this point.
Yep.
He, in his own words, said, with the restless, sickly air of a mad dog, he loaded a pair of double-barreled pistols and bought some women's clothing. He bought a maid's outfit to disguise himself as when he got back to Paris. And there he was going to shoot Camille, her, as he said, her hippopotamus mother.
Oh my God.
Her fiancé, the piano guy, Pleyel, I think his surname was, and then himself. So he had this massive crime of passion planned out. En route to France, he lost his French maid's outfit and essentially went, oh, the plan has fallen to pieces. If I don't have my French maid's outfit, this was the one that I had to wear for my triple murder. I can't possibly get a replacement for it. And at this point, he had reached Genoa and just went, fuck it, I'll throw myself off the ramparts of Genoa into the Mediterranean and drown myself. Not to make light of someone trying to commit suicide, but in his own words, he was fished out like a salmon by some locals. He had swallowed quite a lot of salt water at that point, so he lay in the sun for 15 minutes and threw up violently for a whole hour.
Oh, good lord.
I mean, music guys, we've got all the good jokes. Yeah. What an advert, blimey.
Our candidates this week for the World's Worst Composer, a Ben suggestion of Gerald Wilson, the 14th Baron Berners, pigeon botherer to the stars. Leah's suggestion of František Kocsvara, the asphyxie wank star of the late 18th century. And my suggestion of Hector Berlioz on his way to Paris. We've got Mad Eccentric Aristocrat, tick, Worstwood Forward listeners. We've got Big Hitter, not living up to their grand reputation in other aspects of their life. And we've got a one-hit wonder.
Who took his own breath away.
Who took his own breath away. It's really nice to have three who would all be great winners, but I feel, I was about to say, Kocsvara stands head and shoulders above the rest
of
us.
God, his name is,
and his name is literally like Kocsvara, come on.
His name is literally Kocsvara, yes. So, for writing his own Times version of Video Killed the Radio Star and then dying in a historically memorable fashion, František Kocsvara, you are our world's worst composer. Well done, Leah. Before we go, I've got to very briefly give you the world's best news of the week. And this is a story from Denver, Colorado. A family cat has been reunited with its owners after getting stuck in a reclining armchair that was donated to a charity shop.
Oh.
They had a ginger cat, this family. They were preparing to move out of their house. They had a ginger cat called Montekia, who had apparently somehow gotten inside the chair mechanism. And the employees from the shop discovered him meowing, called the Denver Animal Shelter to pick him up on New Year's Eve. And then his microchip hadn't been updated, sadly. But the family, well done them, they noticed the cat was missing. And they must know their cat so well, because they thought he must have hidden in the armchair. They called the charity shop. And they were like, yeah, they'd handed him into an animal shelter. So they were reunited hours later. A police officer involved in the case said the owners were crying with joy to have their cat returned. Montekia appeared relieved to be home. And Denver Animal Shelter posted a photo on Facebook, said, we're so happy for the ending to the story and thankful for everyone involved in getting this sweet cat home safely. So the world may be on fire, but one little cat in Colorado is back with its human parents. So aww, that makes everything a little bit better. Leah, before we go, where can people find out a little bit more about you and your work?
So you can follow me on Twitter at Leah Broad, or you can go to my website, leahbroad.wordpress.com, and there will be more information there if you so wish.
Very good. Meanwhile, we're all off to return these French maid outfits to the fancy dress shop and try and come up with a better costume for Halloween. Thanks for listening to Westwood Forward. Goodbye.
Goodbye.